experience elliptic cohomology. But I want to start by getting us all on the same page, saying something about what elliptic cohomology is. And before I get there, I'd like to just say something about equivariant cohomology theories in general. So to start out, let A be a cohomology theory. So it's something that takes as input spaces and spits out as output abelian groups, or in our case, it'll spit out rings. It'll be a multiplicative cohomology theory. So what do we mean by an equivariant version of the cohomology theory A? Well, suppose that G is a compact Lie group. Then we would be talking about a cohomology theory where the input is not just arbitrary topological spaces, but topological spaces with an action of the group G will have defined some G equivariant A cohomology groups of A, and these will be normalized. They should be related to the original cohomology theory A in the following way. If G acts freely, then the G equivariant cohomology of X is just going to be the ordinary cohomology of the quotient X modulo G. Now, there's always a prescription which will satisfy this condition. That is, it's given by the Borel construction. So by definition, the Borel equivariant A cohomology of X, well, you take X, which is a space on which G acts. Maybe G doesn't act freely, but you replace X by a space on which G does act freely. And you want a space that's as closely related to X as you can find. So one way of doing this is to take the product of X with a contractible space on which G is acting freely. And you define this to be the ordinary cohomology of X cross EG modulo the diagonal action of G. This is called doing the Borel construction on X. So this gives an answer, a prescription which satisfies this condition, but in some circumstances it's not the prescription that you're looking for. So the canonical example is where A is the cohomology theory complex K theory. So the complex K theory of a space X is defined to be, for nice spaces X at least, the Grothendieck group of complex vector bundles on X. And that has a natural G equivariant analog. If a compact Lie group G is acting on X, you can consider not all vector bundles on X, but vector bundles that are equipped with a compatible action of the group G. So KG of a space X is the Grothendieck group of G equivariant vector bundles on X. In particular, if X is a point, a G equivariant vector bundle on a point is just a representation of G, and you just recover the classical representation ring of the group G. On the other hand, this Borel construction gives a slightly different answer. If you plug in X equal point, what you get is the ordinary cohomology, in this case the ordinary K theory, of EG modulo G, or the classifying space of G. So the Borel construction gives the K theory of BG, and these two answers are never the same unless G is trivial. But they're closely related. There's a map from the left-hand side to the right-hand side, and according to the Attias-Siegel theorem, this map is not far from being an isomorphism. So according to Attias and Siegel, this map exhibits the right-hand side as a suitable completion of the left-hand side, a completion with respect to the augmentation ideal of representations of virtual dimension zero. So I'd like to see how this goes in a special case where... Yes. Theorem, this is a completion. We'll see in an example more precisely what's going on. So, sub-example of this example, let's take G to be the circle group. All right, then KG of a point, this is the representation ring of the circle. Well, every representation of the circle is a direct sum of irreducibles. Since the circle is abelian, all of the irreducibles are one-dimensional. They're given by characters. And every character of the circle is just an integral power of the defining character, given by identifying the circle with the unit complex numbers. So this representation ring is just a Laurent polynomial ring on one variable u, where u corresponds to the identity representation, the circle acting on the complex plane by rotations. On the other hand, the Borel equivariant K-theory of a point, this is the ordinary K-theory of the classifying space, which in this case is infinite-dimensional complex projective space, CP infinity. This is a suitable completion of this Laurent polynomial ring. It's a completion with respect to the augmentation ideal, which in this case is generated by u minus 1. So what you end up with is a power series ring on one variable, which I'll call u minus 1. And this map is just what you think it is. It carries u to u minus 1 plus 1. Okay, so the reason that I'm spelling this example out is because it has a natural algebra geometric interpretation. If you're an algebraic geometer and I show you this ring, you will immediately recognize this is the ring of functions on the multiplicative group GM, considered as an algebraic group over the integers. On the other hand, what's this ring? This is the ring of germs of functions near the identity element as a point of GM. And this map is just what you think it is. It takes a function which is defined on the entire multiplicative group and restricts it to a formal neighborhood of the identity element in the multiplicative group. So, now you might ask, how good is this correspondence that I'm describing? You know, I've named this thing GM. GM has a group structure. Could we, for example, see the group structure from the point of view, thinking about this as some kind of equivariant K-theory? And the answer is yes, but we have to think not just about circle equivariant K-theory, but about torus equivariant K-theory. So let T be a torus, i.e., it's some product of copies of S1. And now we have a functor from tori to schemes, which takes a torus T to the spectrum of the T equivariant K theory of a point, or in other words, the representation ring of T. Now, this is a covariant functor. The T equivariant cohomology of a point, that's a contravariant functor of T, but taking its spectrum is again a contravariant functor, so this composition is covariant. And if T is some product of S1s, it just goes to the corresponding product of GMs. That is, by direct calculation, you can see that this functor commutes with products. So what this means is that if we have some kind of algebraic structure on a torus, like, say, the structure of an abelian group, then this functor carries that to the same sort of algebraic structure on the image. So because a torus is an abelian group, that gives you a group structure on the image of the torus under this functor. S1 in particular goes to the multiplicative group, and the group structure that you get on the multiplicative group is the usual group structure. Okay. So the upshot of this discussion is that there's some relationship between K-theory and the multiplicative group, and in fact this relationship is can be spelled out more strongly if we think not just about ordinary K-theory, but equivariant K-theory. Equivariant K-theory somehow allows us to recover the multiplicative group itself. So, as another example of the same phenomenon, let's consider ordinary cohomology with, say, rational coefficients. Well, ordinary cohomology, there's no particularly compelling choice of equivariant version other than the version that's given by the Borel construction. But if you consider the F1 equivariant cohomology of a point, this is the, maybe I should put in Borel, equivariant cohomology of a point. Well, this is by definition just the cohomology of the classifying space BS1, say with rational coefficients, and this is just a polynomial ring on one variable t by direct calculation. And this, algebraic geometers will again recognize, this is the ring of functions on the additive group GA. And again, by thinking about not just the circle, but tori of higher dimensions, you can see that there ought to be some kind of group structure here, and it agrees with the usual group structure on the additive group GA. So in the same sense that K-theory has something to do with the multiplicative group, ordinary cohomology has something to do with the additive group. So now I can say what elliptic cohomology is. Elliptic cohomology is supposed to be some kind of cohomology theory which has to do with elliptic curves in the same way that K-theory has to do with the multiplicative group and ordinary cohomology has to do with the additive group. So let me be more precise about that. Yes? So the way that I've said this, the analogy is maybe a little fuzzy because of that issue, but there's a way of saying it that sort of makes it a more compelling analogy with this case. Okay. So what's next? A definition. An elliptic cohomology theory is the following data. So one is a cohomology theory A with satisfying some conditions. It should be multiplicative, that is, you should be able to multiply cohomology classes, and it should be even periodic, which means that if you look at the A cohomology of a point, this is supposed to be zero if n is odd, and it's supposed to look the same in all even degrees. In all even degrees, it will be some fixed commutative ring R. So the second piece of data for an elliptic cohomology theory is an elliptic curve. E defined over the ring R. And finally, we want to say somehow that the cohomology theory is related to the elliptic curve. So we require that there be an isomorphism between the Borel equivariant S1 cohomology of a point with the ring of germs of functions on the elliptic curve near the identity. So this is what an elliptic cohomology theory is. Roughly speaking, it's a cohomology theory which is related to an elliptic curve, generalizing the kind of situation we had for K-theory and the multiplicative group. Now, there's sort of two senses in which I want to modify this notion. The first is maybe not so important for what's going to follow, but it's natural here to weaken the periodicity condition. Instead of requiring this to be R in all even degrees, you just require that it be an invertible R module in all even degrees. That lets you treat elliptic curves which don't have a trivial tangent bundle. But the other modification that I want to make is more serious. Let me introduce a definition which is sort of a refinement or a fancier version of this notion of elliptic cohomology theory. An elliptic spectrum is going to be more or less the same thing, but I'm just going to demand that things be a little bit fancier everywhere here. So instead of just having an arbitrary cohomology theory, I'm going to require that I have a commutative ring spectrum or an E-infinity ring spectrum. Now, if you don't know what a commutative ring spectrum is, it's more or less a cohomology theory with a good theory of multiplication. But more to the point, it's a homotopy theorist version of the notion of a commutative ring. And just like you can do classical algebraic geometry using ordinary commutative rings, there's a version of algebraic geometry that you can do with these E-infinity ring spectra or commutative ring spectra that is going to play a role in what follows. But we want to demand that we have a commutative ring spectrum, and again, we're going to require that this be even periodic in the same sense. Over here, we had an elliptic curve defined over spec R. And now I'm going to demand a fancier version of that. R is an ordinary commutative ring, but A is a commutative ring spectrum. And I said you can do algebraic geometry over A, and in particular, you can develop a theory of elliptic curves over A. So we're going to demand that we not just have an elliptic curve over R, but an elliptic curve E living over spec A. Oh, and I should have mentioned 3 here, that this isomorphism should be compatible with the group structure on the elliptic curve. And here we're going to demand the same sort of relationship between the elliptic curve and the cohomology theory we started with, except a refinement of what we have here. So here we have an isomorphism of R algebras. Over here, we want to demand an isomorphism of A algebras. An isomorphism, well, the analog of the cohomology of CP infinity in this setting would be the function spectrum, A to the CP infinity. This is an A algebra, and this we should demand the equivalent to the ring of germs of functions on E near the identity. And this isomorphism should again be compatible with the group structure on E. Spec A star. No. Oh, so A is an E-infinity ring spectrum, and I mean spec A in the sense of derived geometry. So that brings up a question, which is, what do I mean by this? So I don't want to say what I mean by this. That would be another talk. But instead of telling you what this actually means, why don't I tell you how often this occurs, or how much work you have to do, or what situations you get these elliptic cohomology theory or elliptic spectra. So question, how many are there? Well, let's suppose that we start with the commutative ring R and the elliptic curve E over spec R. So start with this. This is classified by a map phi from spec R into the moduli stack of elliptic curves, more or less by definition. Now, two assertions. If phi is flat, then we get a somewhat unique elliptic cohomology theory. That is, there's some procedure by which we can extend this data, produce an elliptic cohomology theory A that has such an isomorphism here. And this is a corollary of Landweber's exact functor theorem. Assertion two, if phi is a tall, then we get a very unique elliptic spectrum. If you assume more about this map, then you could get a much more structured version of elliptic cohomology. So now for the rest of this lecture, I'm going to assume that I'm talking about this more refined notion of an elliptic spectrum. But that's necessary to actually work with these notions and give the proofs of the statements that I'm going to make. But I'm not going to give the proofs in this lecture. So if you don't want to think about E infinity ring spectra or this fancy derived algebraic geometry, you can just think about this more classical version of elliptic cohomology. Think that I'm talking about elliptic cohomology theories. Okay. This goes up? Yeah. All right. So now, what does having an elliptic cohomology theory by you, or an elliptic spectrum? Well, in various lectures that I've given on the subject of elliptic cohomology, people have asked, you know, why is this really called elliptic cohomology? If this notion of an elliptic cohomology theory, it doesn't use much about the elliptic curve. It only uses the elliptic curve near the origin, the formal completion of the elliptic curve. So why is the elliptic curve itself really relevant? Well, for talking about the elliptic cohomology theory itself, the elliptic curve is not really relevant. But if you wanted to talk not about the Borel S1 equivariant cohomology of a point, but the actual S1 equivariant cohomology of a point, the entire structure of the entire elliptic curve would come into play. So if A is an elliptic spectrum, there exists a theory of equivariant A cohomology. And this is essentially, in some sense, determined by the following requirement, that the S1 equivariant A cohomology of a point is the ring of functions on the elliptic curve E. The elliptic curve that the cohomology theory is associated to. So now, in the case of the multiplicative group, this isomorphism was very informative. Because instead of an elliptic curve, we had the multiplicative group, and the multiplicative group is affine. It's determined by its ring of functions. But the elliptic curve, an elliptic curve is not affine. It's complete, and in particular, all regular functions on an elliptic curve are constant. So this isomorphism contains little information in some sense. It's not very interesting, because both sides here are just going to look like the ring R. But you might not be surprised by that. I mean, the right-hand side is not very interesting, but I'm also taking the S1 equivariant cohomology of just a point. So it's not a very interesting space. We're putting very little in and getting very little out. So my objective for the rest of this lecture is to talk about some more interesting things that you can put into this formalism and some more interesting answers that you can get out. But before I get there, I'd like to change gears a little bit and just make some philosophical remarks about a different subject, or a related subject, but so what I'd like to talk about now is the chromatic picture of stable homotopy theory. So Gable homotopy theory means the study of cohomology theories. I'm not going to say much about the chromatic picture of stable homotopy, but I'm just going to tell you roughly what's involved. Well, in the chromatic picture of stable homotopy theory, cohomology theories are organized by their height. So the height is some invariant of a cohomology theory, which ranges from non-negative integers to infinity. So let me give you some examples of cohomology theories of different heights. In height 0, you have rational cohomology. And in height infinity, you have mod p cohomology. And now, roughly speaking, the height is some measure of complexity. It tells you how much information the cohomology theory contains or how hard the cohomology theory is to compute. So the fact that infinity is greater than 0 is some reflection of the fact that it's much easier to do calculations rationally than it is to do them mod p. So this is something that's familiar not only in homotopy theory, but in many areas of mathematics. Working rationally is often easier than working mod p. But what's sort of interesting about homotopy theory is that it provides lots of intermediate amounts of complexity, cohomology theories of intermediate heights. So an example of a cohomology theory of height 1, or maybe I should say of height 0 and 1, the canonical example is complex K-theory. This is a cohomology theory that measures information of height 0 and height 1. And an example of a cohomology theory of higher height, heights 0 through 2, are elliptic cohomology theories. So now, if you're curious about where these numbers, 0, 1, and 2, are coming from, let me remind you that these three cohomology theories that I've named are, in some sense, associated to algebraic groups. Rational cohomology theory has something to do with the additive group. Complex K-theory has something to do with the multiplicative group. And elliptic cohomology theories have something to do with elliptic curves. Now, over the complex numbers, the additive group, well, let's start with elliptic curves, looks like the complex numbers modulo some lattice of rank 2. The multiplicative group looks like C star, which via the exponential map can be identified with C modulo 2 pi iz, or in other words, a lattice of rank 1. And the additive group itself just looks like the complex numbers under addition. So, roughly speaking, these heights correspond to the ranks of the lattices that you have to mod out by to get the groups that are associated to these cohomology theories. Elliptic curve, lattice has rank 2, here the lattice has rank 1, and here the lattice has rank 0. And roughly speaking, there are cohomology theories associated to higher heights, but they're harder to link up with geometry because it's hard to find discrete lattices in the complex numbers of rank larger than 2. Although it's not impossible to link these up with geometry, and that, I think, will be the subject of Mark's talk later in the week. Okay, so there's this chromatic picture of stable homotopy according to which we can associate this height invariant to a cohomology theory, which measures the complexity. So now what I'd like to do is make a more precise statement to the effect that this is measuring complexity. So, this proposition is a paraphrase of some calculations that were done by Ravenel and Wilson. So, let X be a finite, first a definition, a space X, I'll say, is finite if all the homotopy groups of X are finite and almost all of them are zero. So X has finitely many homotopy groups and each of them is a finite group. So proposition is let A be a cohomology theory of height less than or equal to n, and X a finite space. Then the A cohomology of X, I'll put this in quotes, depends only on the first N homotopy groups. Of X. And what I mean by that is that if you have a map of finite spaces, X to Y, and that map induces an isomorphism on the first N homotopy groups, then the induced map in A cohomology is also an isomorphism. So let me spell this out in more detail in some of the more familiar examples. So the first example to consider is n equals 0, and let's take our favorite cohomology theory of height 0, rational cohomology. What this is saying is that if we take a finite space where all the homotopy groups are torsion, and we look at its rational cohomology, well, that just ignores all of the torsion. It completely ignores all of the homotopy groups and only counts the number of connected components. So for finite spaces, rational cohomology can only tell us a very crude invariance of the space. On the other hand, K-theory could tell us a little bit more. It's supposed to give us information about both pi-0 and pi-1 of the spaces. So what are some interesting finite spaces we could feed into K-theory? Well, we might as well feed K-theory connected spaces, because if we give it a disconnected space, we're just going to get the product of the K-theory of the connected components. And according to this proposition, we might as well feed K-theory something which has trivial homotopy groups in dimensions above 1, because killing those homotopy groups won't change the answer. So, corollary, the only interesting finite space for K-theory are classifying spaces BG, where G is finite. Now, in these cases, it is interesting to look at the cohomology, or the K-theory of the space. The K-theory of the classifying space of G, well, that's just the Borel equivariant cohomology of a point. And we've already mentioned that this has a receives a map from the usual G equivariant K-theory of a point, which is just the representation ring of G. And moreover, the Atiyah-Siegel completion theorem gives us a good understanding of this map. It tells us that the right-hand side is just a suitable completion of the left-hand side. So the way that I'd like to describe the situation is this is sort of the nice answer. And the actual answer is obtained from the nice answer by some sort of a messy, potentially messy construction. So this right-hand side is a little bit messier than the left-hand side. For example, its structure at primes that divide the order of the group looks a little bit different from its structure at primes that do not divide the order of the group. On the other hand, this left-hand side is a very well-behaved object. It's just a finitely generated abelian group, free on a number of generators equal to the number of conjugacy classes in the group G. So this answer is well-behaved. This answer is less so. Equivariant K-theory is, in some sense, taking the answers that K-theory produces on these finite spaces and somehow improving them. So now I'd like to discuss the same situation, but at higher height. I'd like to replace K-theory by elliptic cohomology. So now K-theory, the only interesting finite spaces we could feed it were classifying spaces of finite groups because K-theory was height 1. But elliptic cohomology contains height 2 information. That means among these finite spaces, it's supposed to see pi 0, pi 1, and pi 2. So question, let X be a finite space say, with only pi 1 and pi 2 non-trivial. And let A be some elliptic cohomology theory. So then we can take the A cohomology of X, but by analogy with this situation of complex K-theory, we might expect that the answer is a little bit messy, but it's related to something which is less messy. So can we find some sort of less messy answer such that the A cohomology of X is obtained from that by some kind of completion process, some analog of the Atiyah-Siegel completion theorem? And the answer to this question is yes, there's a good theory of these what we put here for the question mark. And that theory is what I call two-equivariant elliptic cohomology. The reason I'm calling it two-equivariant elliptic cohomology is because, well, it's seeing information not only about pi 1, but about pi 2, so it sort of gives you a cohomology theory that you can evaluate not just on orbifolds, which you could do for an equivariant cohomology theory, but for two orbifolds in some sense. But so let me say something about, well, first, a remark. So I've been talking here about finite spaces, but of course, equivariant K-theory is something that's defined not only for finite groups, but for all compact Lie groups. And in some sense, finite groups are the hardest, the worst case. It's a familiar phenomenon. The representation theory of connected compact Lie groups is much, much simpler than the representation theory of finite groups. So, in some sense, the best behaved case here is where G is not finite, but connected. And, in fact, the case that we started out with, the most interesting case, is where G is the circle. And there's similarly, here, we want to allow spaces with only non-trivial pi 1 and pi 2, but pi 1 and pi 2 are in some sense allowed to be compact Lie groups. So I'll be a little bit more precise about that in a moment. Okay. So now I don't know how to lead into what's coming next. So I'm just going to sort of jump into it and say what sort of an apparatus two-equivariant elliptic cohomology is. So let's say I start with an elliptic curve. So given an elliptic curve, E spec R, so two equivariant and associated to this some elliptic spectrum A. So two equivariant elliptic cohomology is going to be some functor from certain spaces, certain topological spaces to R schemes. And so let's call this functor X goes to M sub X. And now what is this supposed to have to do with ordinary A cohomology? It's supposed to be such that if I take the A cohomology of the space X, this cannot be identified with the ring of germs of functions on M sub X near some base point. So in other words, these M sub X's are geometric objects, algebra geometric objects, such that to get the ordinary cohomology of X with coefficients in A, we take those geometric objects and we formally complete them. So now let's make a chart of what these geometric objects are in some important cases. How much time have I got? Ah, plenty of time. So, on the left-hand side here, I'll have some spaces that I can plug into this apparatus. And on the right-hand side, I will have some R schemes, which are the things that pop out of the apparatus. So the basic case is where the space is the classifying space for the circle, or in other words, CP infinity. And the geometric object that's supposed to pop out is the elliptic curve E. What is this saying? What is this assertion saying in this case? It's saying that the A cohomology of CP infinity is supposed to be the ring of germs of functions on E near the identity, which is more or less the definition of what it means for this cohomology theory to be associated to this elliptic curve. So this special case is one that we already understand. A more trivial example, I could take a point, and what this is supposed to go to is a point in the sense of algebraic geometry over R, or just spec R. A more interesting case, but suppose we take the classifying space of a connected compact Lie group G. Then what we're supposed to get, I'll just denote it by M of BG, and this is in quotation marks a moduli space for topologically trivial G bundles on the elliptic curve E. Now, you might object at this point that in the case of where G equals S1, I have two different things on the board here, two a priori different descriptions of what I'm supposed to associate to BS1. But in fact, they're not so different. In the case where G is S1, a G bundle means a line bundle. And if it's topologically trivial, I'm saying the line bundle has degree zero. And so this moduli space is supposed to be the Jacobian of the elliptic curve E. And an elliptic curve is its own Jacobian. So these two descriptions are, in fact, compatible with one another. So now the construction of these spaces is more or less what you need to define equivariant elliptic cohomology. But I want to talk about two equivariant elliptic cohomology, which means I want to extend this construction to spaces that are not just classifying spaces of compact Lie groups, but in some sense also include twofold classifying spaces for compact abelian Lie groups. So another space that I want to consider here is KZ3, which I'm really going to think of as KS12, or the twofold classifying space of the circle. And the geometric object that I'm going to associate to this is something very simple. It's just going to be the multiplicative group. Now, that's the most interesting space I can feed that has some non-trivial pi 2. But the really interesting situation is when we have spaces that have both pi 1 and pi 2 interacting somehow. So now I want to consider spaces with, so this is in quotes because I don't mean the sort of ordinary homotopy groups, which would be discrete groups, but in some sense, spaces in which pi 1 is a compact Lie group G, and pi 2 is going to be the circle. So what does this mean, not in quotes? It means that I want to consider spaces X that fit in a fibration sequence where the base is the classifying space of G and the fiber is KS12, or in other words, KZ3. So now, how are spaces like this classified? These are classified by levels on the group G. In other words, maps from BG into KZ4, or in other words, classes eta in H4 of BG with integral coefficients. So any level on the group G, any cohomology class in degree 4, gives you a fibration sequence like this. And now, if we have a fibration sequence like this, we might expect a similar fibration sequence in the world of R schemes. So So if we have such a vibration sequence, we're going to produce a space M sub X mapping to M sub BG. And the fiber is going to be GM. It's going to be the total space of a GM torsor on BG. In other words, a line bundle on M sub BG. So two equivariant elliptic cohomology is some apparatus which coherently associates to this sort of data some R schemes. Now the line bundles that come up, maybe I should say a word or two about them just to give you an idea of what they look like. Well, let me just mention the most important special case. If G is S1 cross S1, then a level is something that lives in, is a class eta that lives in H4 of CP infinity cross CP infinity. And the cohomology of CP infinity cross CP infinity is a polynomial ring on two generators, T1 and T2, that both live in degree 2. So you could take eta to be the product, T1 times T2. Now, you can think of a level in this case also. It's a map from KZ2 cross KZ2 into KZ4. In other words, it's a cohomology operation, which takes two cohomology classes of degree 2 and produces a cohomology class of degree 4. And the cohomology operation that I want to think about is the cup product, just multiplying the cohomology classes. So in this case, we're supposed to get a line bundle on M sub BG. Well, if G is a product of two circles, M sub BG turns out to be a product of two copies of the elliptic curve E. And the line bundle that you're supposed to get is the Poincaré bundle. In other words, it's the line bundle that you use to identify E with its own Jacobian. So you get the Poincaré bundle. Now, these line bundles that appear here, they're not anything new. They were constructed by Luzhenga, and they're sort of well studied by people in certain areas of mathematics. So what I'm actually saying that's new here is I was lying to you a little bit about the setup. We're actually starting with an elliptic spectrum A, which means that the elliptic curve E should be defined over A. So I really should have said two equivariant elliptic cohomology is some process which goes from certain topological spaces and produces certain A schemes, certain objects that live in derived algebraic geometry. But anyway, what's the upshot of all this? What does this let you do? Well, it gives you some additional things that you can think about when you want to talk about equivariant elliptic cohomology. So let G be a compact Lie group, and let L be an H4 of BG with integral coefficients, so that we get a line bundle L over this M sub BG. Now, the G equivariant elliptic cohomology of a point, Borel equivariant cohomology, is given by some completion of the ring of functions on this geometric object MG. That's what this isomorphism is telling us. Well, the actual G equivariant cohomology is supposed to just give us the entire ring of regular functions on M sub BG. But as we saw earlier, when G was a circle, this is maybe not such an interesting statement, because this is going to turn out to be a compact variety, and it's not going to have any non-constant functions. On the other hand, there exists a notion of the G equivariant cohomology at level L, which for a point would just give us sections of the line bundle L over M of BG. And this is potentially much more interesting, because if the level L is chosen to be positive in a suitable sense, then this line bundle that we produce over M sub BG turns out to be ample. So it will have many sections. So now what I'd like to do is say something about what you get for a special example of an elliptic cohomology theory. So now I need to make another digression, say something about the Tate curve. So an elliptic curve over the complex numbers is defined to be something that you get when you take C modulo a radius of rank 2. Equivalently, it's something that you get when you take C star modulo a lattice of rank 1. So one way that you can get an elliptic curve is to take C star modulo Q to the Z, and this is defined as long as Q is sufficiently small, the absolute value of Q is between 0 and 1. But this is a complex analytic construction. It's an observation of Tate that, in fact, if you require Q to be very, very small, you can mimic the same construction purely algebraically. So there exists an algebraic version, and it's defined over the integers, adjoin a parameter Q, which is very, very small but non-zero. In other words, D double parentheses Q. And so this produces a curve, which I'll call E Tate. It's an elliptic curve over the spectrum of Z double brackets Q, which you can think of morally as the multiplicative group modulo Q to the Z, in some sense. Now, what does this look like? What does the classifying space for this thing look like? Well, the moduli stack of elliptic curves is non-compact. It's sort of missing a point at infinity where elliptic curves develop singularities. The Tate curve is classified by some map from spec Z adjoin Q into this moduli stack of elliptic curves. So how should you think about Z brackets Q? Well, first you take a power series ring in Q. So if your Q has to be very small to evaluate arbitrary power series, so it's some very small disk around Q equals 0, but then you invert Q, so you delete the middle of the disk. So you should think about this as a very small punctured disk. And this maps to the moduli stack of elliptic curves by mapping that to a very small disk around the missing point infinity. So this map is technically not a tall, but morally is a tall. It's close enough to being an atoll map that you can actually use this to produce an elliptic spectrum. Now, an elliptic spectrum, remember, the definition is probably gone. Yes. But the notion of an elliptic spectrum really only uses a neighborhood of the identity in the elliptic curve. And this elliptic curve looks like the multiplicative group near the identity. So we get an elliptic cohomology theory. But the elliptic cohomology theory we get is just a variant on K-theory. It's called, some people call this K-theory. It's just what you might think of as K-theory, double parentheses Q. Now, as an ordinary cohomology theory, this is just a mild variation on K-theory. But if we think about it equivariantly, then equivariant elliptic cohomology uses not just a formal neighborhood of the identity in the elliptic curve, but the entire elliptic curve. So the Tate curve, in a neighborhood of the identity, it looks like the multiplicative group, but globally it's very different from the multiplicative group. So the upshot of that is that equivariant Tate K-theory is not just going to be equivariant K-theory, a joint power series generator Q. It's going to be something different. So how is it different? Well, the equivariant, G-equivariant K-theory of a point has to do with the representation theory of the group G. And in the same sense, it turns out that the G-equivariant Tate K-theory of a point has something to do with the representation theory of the loop group of G. So let me close by describing what that relationship is. So let G be a compact, and to be safe, let me say connected Lie group. So the loop group of G is the space of maps, say smooth maps, from a circle into G. Now, the representation theory of the loop group itself is typically not very interesting until you make a central extension. So earlier, I mentioned that a level on the group G is a map from BG into KV4, but an equivalent point of view on the level is that it's exactly what you need to define a central extension of the loop group of G by the circle. So this level gives rise to a central extension like so. And now there's another circle in the game. So let me call this the central circle. This is S1 central. There's another circle in the game, which is this circle here that's parametrizing the loops. And that circle has a group structure which acts by rotations. So where do I want to write this? So let me call this second circle that's acting by rotations the energy circle. So that acts on the loop group of G by rotating the loops, and that extends to an action on this centrally extended loop group. So now I want to consider positive energy representations of this centrally extended loop group together with the central circle. So I always forget which way this symbol goes. Do I have it right or wrong? I have it wrong? Like that? Is that good? Okay. So I want to consider representations of the semi-direct product of this centrally extended loop group with the energy circle. So what do I mean by that? What I mean by that is representations V of this group such that the central circle acts by the identity character, not the trivial character, but the identity character, rotations on the complex numbers. And now V splits into a direct sum of isotypics with respect to the action of the energy circle. Has some decomposition into energy levels. We call these energy eigenspaces. And the requirement is that these V sub n's are finite dimensional for all n and zero for n less, much smaller than zero. Okay, so this is the notion of a positive energy representation. And now, the theorem that I wanted to get to in this lecture is let L be a level on the group G. Then we can take the Tate K theory, G equivariant at level L of a point. And let me also mention that L should be positive. More precisely, L needs to be larger than the dual Coxeter number of G. But under suitable positivity conditions, if I think about the elliptic cohomology, G equivariant at level L, then what I'm supposed to get is the Grothendieck group of positive energy representations of LG tilde semi-direct product S1. And now, just a remark, what is this theorem saying, or sort of where does this fit into the picture? Well, since Witten, there's been this sort of heuristic that elliptic cohomology is supposed to be something like, the elliptic cohomology of a space X is supposed to be something like the S1 equivariant K theory of the loop space of X. And this is, in some sense, a precise instance of this heuristic in a special case. Anyway, my time is up, so I will stop there. I guess me. But I don't know. I mean, the definition of this is, well, I guess there's a classical version of this that you could take the sections of that without, as an isomorphism of abelian groups, I guess you could formulate it without defining two equivariant elliptic cohomology. But L time. Well, level L defines a particular central extension. Yes.
During the 80s, there was a strong idea that these centrally extended loop groups were a lot like compact groups.
Uh huh.
And you're somehow, are you saying in a way that you should really probably think of them as just compact, two groups?
Well, yeah, you sort of have a two orbifold, which is BG extended by KS12, and that, yeah, in the same sense that representation theory of the group is some kind of a vector bundle on the classifying space of the group, these things have something to do with maybe vector bundles on that is not the right thing to say, but whatever elliptic cohomology is measuring. There is, well, so let me make a remark. This is an isomorphism of Z adjoined Q modules. So how is Z adjoined Q acting in this situation? Here, on this side, it's acting because KK theory is defined over K adjoined Q, but on this side, Q is acting by shifting the energy level. And this is some kind of completion near Q equals zero. So these positive energy representations are not, that I'm talking about, are not finite sums of irreducibles. You can take infinite sums of irreducibles as long as the energies are tended to infinity. So in some sense, it is completed. It's completed near Q equals zero. Well, the philosophy is that sort of you should have to have height 2 in order to have an interesting two equivariant cohomology theory. And the particular construction of two equivariant elliptic cohomology uses very strongly things that are very particular to elliptic curves, like the fact that elliptic curves are self-dual that appeared somewhere in this lecture.
You said when it was BS1 to infinity, you associated an elliptic curve.
Yes.
And when it became more complicated, when it was KS12, the Kalman-Bremer space of S1 to 2, then the object you associated was GM, which was simpler. So is there some sort of pattern there that's going on?
Well, so I paraphrased this result of Ravenel and Wilson. Their result is actually much more precise. They actually compute what certain height n cohomology theories do on certain spaces with certain finite spaces. And one of the things that their calculations show is that if you have a cohomology theory of height exactly n, and you compute it on sort of spaces which are k pi n's, then you expect to see things that look like roots mu k's appearing, like multiplicative type groups. So it's expected that sort of in the height, if you consider a KS1 comma height, then you should see something like the multiplicative group based on this calculation of Ravenel and Wilson.